Welcome to Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell. I've been curious about artificial intelligence for a while, but more recently I've been thinking about the kind of core concepts of generation and the understanding of life with regards to simulation. It feels like there's a lot of discussion about intelligence, but not very much about life and how evolution emerges. I thought it might be nice to get kind of a feeling of that from maybe an expert in the field. And luckily, I happen to work with somebody that is such that expert. Tom Barbalay is an iOS developer at Netflix with me. And Tom, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Thank you. I don't know if I fulfill any of those introductory points, but it's probably interesting at least to talk. I mean, my perspective actually is that one has a certain amount of life experience, and one certainly wants to remain curious in these circumstances. I think most people with a certain degree of curiosity amass a certain amount of information. I just have particular proclivities, which means that the way in which I've amassed information has come through areas that are perhaps slightly less well-trodden. But I think in general, talking to people that just have their wits about them gives a remarkably... I mean, for example, if you read Darwin, he talks about the pigeon fancier. So I guess you're talking to a digital pigeon fancier of a particular domain. Let's just put it that way.
When he talks about the pigeon fancier, he's talking about someone who's like dealing with pigeons.
Yeah.
A geek about pigeons.
But moreover, it's the notion that the geek is actually better than the scientist. It's the notion that someone that's obsessed with something will have a level of knowledge that the scientist may not necessarily have. And I think certainly if I was to be called an expert in anything, it's that I've been doing the same kind of work with a wide variety of different operating systems, different kinds of computers. I mean, everything has changed,
yeah,
except for the underlying idea, and that's with my primary simulation, Noble Ape.
Are you familiar with Werner Venge's work, Deepness in the Sky, his novel?
Mm-hmm.
He talks about that idea of the fascinated individual. In fact, becomes the futuristic replacement of a computer, mm-hmm, is a person that's obsessed with an idea. Okay, so let's talk about Noble Ape, obviously,
yes,
the thing I was referring to with regards to life simulation.
Mm-hmm.
Describe to me Noble Ape to someone who had noticed nothing about it.
From a relatively young age, I was surrounded by Luddites. And what they said to me was that there would be no way to simulate a wide variety of things that I thought were simulatable relatively easily, a priori.
Like what kind of thing?
Like the natural environment, for example. The rich biological ecosystems and the things that we experience. I mean, you may not think of like the 101 or the 280 or these kind of things as rich biological ecosystems. For folks listening in, these are freeways in the Bay Area. But there are a wide variety of things that we encounter in our day-to-day which are actually rich ecosystems. And in order to understand ecosystems on any level, you must start to have the twinge that they're simulatable in some sense.
When you talk about an ecosystem, you're talking, mm-hmm, about a system that is so complex that it has an emergent quality to it? Is that,
yeah,
kind of how you
Why
think
not?
Of it?
Yeah, that's, okay, that's one possibility.
Right.
So with Noble Ape, I wanted to take it from two different perspectives. I wanted to create a rich ecosystem, which the apes lived in. It started off being an island, but then it became a planetary simulation. And within that ecosystem, I wanted to have the perspective that every point in the simulation, the external simulation, was unique. And that was something that was very important to me from a philosophical sense, but also a mathematical sense. So when I started doing Noble Ape, I was 19 at the time, a university student in Australia. It was very much to create an external simulation that was unique at every point, but then also to create an internal simulation, which was the Noble Apes, their cognitive simulation fundamentally. And the Noble Apes are humanoid-like creatures that wander over the ecological simulation that I created and do a wide variety of relatively mundane things initially, and then from that you can start running societal simulations, you can start putting in radical agents. You know, what happens if one of the apes just decides randomly to start poisoning the rest of the apes? How will they respond? Or, alternatively, what distinguishes certain tribes and certain areas and groups of apes from other groups of apes? How do they create language? This kind of stuff. So from a relatively young age, prior to actually doing...
Sorry, what you described right there seems so complex to,
mm-hmm,
me that I can see why people are like, oh, I can't simulate that.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is a level of complexity that as you add every little aspect to,
mm-hmm,
what you said, I'm trying to think of codifying that, and it becomes kind of... It explodes
with
complexity.
Consider Noble Ape as a clearinghouse of simulations. So what Noble Ape was originally was just these two simulations, and then I started...
The island environment, mm-hmm, and the ape brain.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then I just started adding more simulations, and then I had other, I mean, it's open source, so then I had other people come and contribute simulations. Some of the aspects of this was done by engineers at Apple and Intel, but also independent thinkers. A fellow by the name of Bob Mottram in the UK contributed 3.5 years worth of his time.
What kind of stuff did he focus on?
He focused on language. He focused on the work at MIT of Cynthia Brazil associated with social robotics that you could define four scalars that would, you know, affect the apes. Notions like reproduction, social things, hunger, these kind of things, that they could be driving forces and simulate things. But his most interesting work was associated with language and in particular internal narrative. So the notion that the noble apes could have 6 actors within their heads playing out scenes, and they could preemptively use these actors as a way of evolutionarily improving certain aspects of their social interaction. So, I mean, I think it's relatively trivial to say that most people, maybe before they do something particularly, you know, stressful or something like that, they might think, well, if I did this, what would happen? If I did that, what would happen?
And those were just codified into the idea of agents that had a certain motivation and they compare each other.
But they were actually internal to the apes. And the way that they communicated that was through language. So there was a language that Bob Mottram created where the apes would have an internal narrative, and then they would have an external narrative, and they would actually communicate what was going on internally, particularly associated with their internal social simulations, through this spoken language. What was fascinating through that was you got the notion of deity, but you also got the notion of hostile rumor. So he had this notion of an epic score, which means that as the apes communicated and interacted, the ape that was being communicated about the most rose in a kind of hierarchical graph, basically. And what we found was that there were a couple of occasions, in fact, more than a couple, where because language mutates, as you talk, there's the whole notion of, you know, whispers games, sure, where people whisper in each other's ears and the words change. Well, language is not precise. It's actually, you can use language in many ways analogous to genetics in terms of mutation. Mm-hmm. So,
hence the term the meme.
Yeah, exactly. So there were circumstances where through mutation, people's parents would become confused. And the notion is through conversation, parents would be changed. And additional parents, this is the classic soap opera, right?
Yeah.
But this is the soap opera in simulation. And through this, the apes that had this mutation around their parents would be talked about more. So this is a notion of emergence.
Were they talked about more because people wanted clarity, or the apes wanted clarity?
Exactly.
Okay, so more questions were asked.
Exactly, like, okay, yes. So you get all these beautiful emergent properties, and that really is what motivates me. And look, to be frank, a good portion of Noble Ape is dealing with Apple's latest operating system changes, and it's about maintaining software fundamentally.
It's a big piece of it.
So, so, you know, I've just rewritten a bunch of stuff on Metal for,
for speed.
Well, because they've eliminated OpenGL. So, there are a series of things that occur through this, which aren't highbrow intellectual discussions. But actually, what's fascinating through this, and I've been doing it for 22, 23 years now, is just the amount of emergent behavior that you can find through doing this kind of work.
Through technically kind of simple, I mean, from a perspective of how life actually works, relatively simple rule sets that produce really complex things.
So let's talk about rule sets, because I think certainly if you're familiar with the Sims and the Maxis products, Will Wright's extended work, he heavily used rule sets, although in his later work he moved more into, I guess, what would be loosely called fuzzy logic in kind of popular discussion. Mm-hmm. So there are very few explicit scalars in Noble Ape. There are very few explicit variables that define things like hunger or sexual attraction or this kind of stuff. Bob Mottram added some of that so he could work in parallel with Cynthia Brazil's work. But in general, I don't look at creating scalar absolutes. So there are very few rules that actually come through this. My background is in physics and philosophy. So my interest is more creating physics of simulation and seeing what emerges through that. So rather than creating explicit rules, although there are basic rules in Noble Ape, it's more associated with creating a rich environment and then seeing what these agents produce through moving through that environment. And I think people that think in terms of rules miss a lot of the subtlety that actually comes through this kind of simulation. And really, very early on in writing this, I encountered people that said, well, these are just rules. You're just explicitly saying, you know, if this thing happens, then this thing happens. I said, no, it's not like that at all.
Well, then what is it like?
It's like particles finding paths and things like that. I mean, once you start layering, there's a beautiful thing about complexity which exists in the natural world as well, which is in ecosystems that have complexity in them tend to be more stable, which is one of those curious things, that actually the interplay of these things, if there isn't mass extinction or external factors, what makes an ecosystem is a very curious kind of stability that comes through complexity. Mm-hmm. So my perspective is, if you want to be tuning something continuously, put in rules, then you're constantly in states that you can't control.
Unstable but, states, yeah. Sure.
I mean, one of the simulations in Noble Ape is a weather simulation, right? Which I've changed a little bit recently, but basically it's been the same weather simulation for the past 15, 20 years. In fact, ironically, after I launched it formally, I was contacted by a bunch of meteorologists that actually liked it. I mean, you can do... The curious thing with Noble Ape is you can do a bunch of stuff just as a hobbyist and actually get feedback from scientists in that particular area. But let's talk about the weather simulation. The weather simulation for Noble Ape is intended to run for generations, hundreds of years worth of simulation time. So if I started creating a weather simulation that was based on rules and just said, if it's raining, then do this, or, you know, these kind of things, you wouldn't have the implicit stability which would enable it to run for long periods of time. And more importantly, if you start, it's almost, I don't want to use the quantum mechanics analogy, but it's almost like quantum mechanics. If you become too tight associated with certain things, you basically force the simulation to behave in ways that will mean it won't run for a long period of time.
Yeah, it's unstable. It goes to a maximum or minimum and it stays there.
Exactly.
So try to explain to me a little bit more about how the weather system works without a whole bunch of rule sets. Are you saying that the rule sets you have are like gravity and temperature and expansion?
No, not at all. Not at all. Okay. So the weather simulation is actually loosely based on the notion of atmosphere as a sponge. So what happens is you have a almost like a glass ceiling, and the various undulations that you have associated with the geography squeezes the atmosphere at various points and kind of squishes out water and has various other things. I've added more recently an explicit wind vector in localized areas and these kind of things. So just the original weather simulation was very basic in terms of how it handled the movement. I mean, ultimately, you're dealing with pressure and water vapor, fundamentally. Temperature is an interesting one. We can talk a little bit more about temperature later. But I was just looking at pressure and water vapor initially. And the simulation was based on... I did a physics degree, so in terms of discrete two-dimensional mathematics, this kind of stuff. But it was very much just a hypothesis of maybe you can represent weather like this. And it worked for as long as I really needed. The stuff that I've added more recently associated with wind and these kind of behaviors, there was a localized notion of wind, which was just a transference of pressure. But I've added an explicit notion of kind of vector movement wind because I've moved more towards planetary simulation. And I think what interests me going forward is what I can take from Noble Ape as a toroidal, but it's a small toroidal simulation, to something which is vastly larger. And it's work that I've been doing since about 2000. I mean, the nature of Noble Ape is actually that there's a simulation itself, but there are, I think, 7 or 8 sub-projects which deal with certain aspects of things that I'd like to integrate in the future, almost like sketch pads, basically.
Okay.
In that regard, so for example, I have an urban simulation, which is currently called the Mushroom Boy. But that uses the simulation principles in Noble Ape, particularly how I had an early generation of plants in particular, and how you can build single-story homes. It's suburban initially, but you can actually build skyscrapers with a similar logic to it. So it's the notion of...
It's the same logic as plants?
Yeah, in terms of... You can create a... You create a series of primitives which are almost fractal-like in basis.
Okay.
And then from that logic, you can create quite easily two-dimensional buildings. And then you can create three-dimensional buildings as well.
When you say create, are you actually coding those, or are you saying here's some rules for an urban environment and it
exactly
emerges?
That's the plan.
Okay.
You have to have if I was explicitly coding. So the Mushroom Boy, I think, is about It's about 128 by 128 city blocks, each containing about 8 housing structures, maybe it's 16 from memory. And there's a bunch of gardens and other things like formal, multi-block gardens that are put in the suburban environment as well. That can only be done. I mean, every run of the simulation from Mobile 8, but also the urban simulation, is a unique environment. So I'm very much looking at ideas of how to create, random things,
right,
that look like a suburban environment or look like a large-scale natural environment.
And then therefore have the ecosystem qualities of those environments.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Can we, since this reminds me so much of some things that are more in pop culture,
mm-hmm,
like Spore, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So can you tell me a little bit about how the comparative, just because that does come up, I think it's come up for other people as well. Spore, to describe this is a game. You can kind of think of it as sim life, but you start at a small organic level and grow up. And the idea is that you're helping this creature to evolve. You're controlling its involvement. And it goes to interstitial flight. And it's a game. Mm-hmm. Is that a good synopsis of that thing? Describe how that kind of environment, that's very different than Noble Ape. How is it different than Noble Ape?
Will Wright and I share a number of the same ideas. So, I mean, I think what's interesting here is actually probably there are more similarities than there are differences, except Will Wright is looking to make a commercial game. I'm looking to create something that primarily other individuals and I as well can find collective wonder in. So I've always thought of my work as more philosophical satire than it is science in that light. My perspective is that we have similarities. However, Will Wright isn't starting with a kind of global notion. He's creating entities which are playable in a game. In terms of procedural movement and things like that, there are some shared similarities. But I think certainly Will's motivation is very much associated with the user generating a vast quantity of wonder in the environment and interacting with it. I guess to a certain extent I share that view as well.
Mm-hmm.
Except the stuff that I'm creating is more associated with emergent social properties and testing emergent social properties, but also actually looking at the boundaries of simulation, like looking at how computation, I mean, this is why Apple and Intel used Noble Ape, because they are obviously creating the boundaries of computation in some regard. They're looking for faster multi-core processor use and all this kind of stuff. So my interest in creating Noble Ape was, to return to the original point, was to fulfill a dare, fulfill a notion that computer simulations could not do this thing, which I thought was fundamentally implausible, but then also to see how far I could go with this thing. And what fascinates me about Noble Ape is I'm never bored, right? So the level of detail that one can get to with these things is only really limited to, one's time and one's interest. Another community that we both kind of share is the model rail, or the rail community in broad terms. And I think I've found a kinship, even though I'm not a model railroader, with the model rail community, because they're basically motivated by the same thing. They want to construct this amazingly elaborate layout of, a certain level of detail, usually at a particular time, usually. And I think that's really my motivation with Noble Ape, is just to see how far this thing can go. Now, historically, I would have talked to you about the Iranian Terminators and a bunch of other things, which I could talk about as well, associated with how Noble Ape has been used in curious ways. But increasingly, Noble Ape for me is just something many who work in the tech industry might understand this, a way that I can return to something very familiar and do accumulative progress, mm-hmm, in a variety of areas. Now, unfortunately, I think not personally, but through friends of mine, reached out to Will Wright, and Will Wright and I share a number of friends, associated with the thought that maybe he really should be doing the kind of simulation that I'm doing with Noble Ape, just for his own personal cathartic benefit. Because the games industry is brutal. Let me say that again. The games industry is brutal. And his experience with Spore was basically it's the last commercial game he ever worked on, right? So in doing something that he wanted to do in a very particular fashion, he broke his own interaction with the games community. And I think that's what was fascinating for me. Historically, I'm talking 10, 15 years ago, I was contacted by games companies that wanted to use these kind of simulations, not only for creating rich ecosystem environments that people go into, and now vastly complex games are,
they have that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But also how on earth do you test these things? Like, these are practical things. The games community wants testable software that will go out and not break for everyone. And the fear with regards to rich ecosystems and ecology is there's going to be some case where some bird is kind of jerking backwards and forwards and people get stuck in some vortex of, you know, craziness that just can't be interpreted when the game is originally written. And while I was sympathetic in part to that, I think Will Wright was really at the vanguard of trying to move the stuff that I'm doing more into the commercial sphere. So kudos to him. But unfortunately, he was caught in, you know, the paradoxes of game development at the time. And my hope is that in 10 years' time, this kind of stuff will just be so omnipresent. And increasingly, if you look at AR and these kind of things, increasingly, the folks that I've worked with historically, and these are broader simulators that were part of a group called Biota that we can probably talk about at some stage, they've gone on to make the movements, which is making this stuff more present for, you know, general game players in the future.
So, to try to describe what you're talking about as a creative process for you, mm-hmm. is it's a highly complex engineering task that also has a philosophical driver that puts you over and over for over 20 years working on code to what kind of things are you gaining from it, besides the play aspect that you have?
You return to the complexity aspect. I don't start with the notion that these things are complex. I start with relatively primary physics ideas and then just see where they go. The vastness of the simulation, the complexity in the simulation comes through emergent properties that I don't explicitly program. However...
So they're interesting.
When you get to a circumstance where you have... You see, I mean, historically in the philosophy of this thing, there was always these competing ideas, you know, certain determinism ideas, a duality with regards to, you know, the mind versus the external world, all this stuff. And they always created all these kind of competitive things that were supposed to be a paradox if you put these... The notion of Noble Ape's philosophical satire is that I can put all those simulations together and I can make them work together. I can make them work together, right? So years, 200 plus years of philosophy, you just
simulated.
Put this stuff together, right? And you see what happens. And actually,
give me an example.
Okay, so there are notions in determinism associated with the kind of mind-body problem, which are purely created by philosophers wanting to, you know, write their own stuff. So I started very much with a dualist perspective with Noble Ape, just to make it fun, okay, from my perspective at least. And then through that, the paradoxes that you get through this, then you take something else.
Like what kind of paradox would you potentially get philosophically?
Philosophically, you want the mind to have properties which the brain doesn't have, for example. And you want a variety of additional things that come through certain aspects of the philosophy. I don't necessarily want to bore your listeners. But there are all these paradoxes which are created philosophically which don't actually need to exist. They just are the nature of what philosophers do. Then through that, you can start putting very non-dualist ideas in there, particularly associated with physical interaction links, chemistry examples. So I put sleep in Noble Ape very early on because I thought that what was really fascinating was the nature of the dream state with consciousness. Mm-hmm. In fact, I don't think you can actually explain consciousness without the dream state. My perspective is that we do so much of our background processing in dreams that it was critical to have the notion of the dream state and to have actually a brain chemistry to detail that accordingly.
Wait, do you have chemistry of the brain for these apes?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. How does their brain think?
Well, it's just, okay, so the cognitive simulations that started out was based on two fundamental ideas. That was that the apes needed a reactive fear, but the apes also needed a long-term desire. So in day-to-day life, maybe to get a paycheck, I don't know.
Sure.
To, yeah, I don't know, have a conversation with right. someone, to spend time with loved ones, you know, these things that exist in human examples. Also, particularly, you find the nature of tastes with foods and these kind of things, just the way that people chart out their existence
yeah.
is based on desires, right? But they needed to be able to survive as well. Early on within the simulation, there were cats. There were large predatorial cats because I like large predatorial cats, right? It was my simulation. I got to put them in there. So they had to have a means of actually dealing with the notion that they could either be eaten or that there was some underlying thing out there. And you see this a lot with primatology, the notion of the snake.
Yeah.
The snake has many different metaphors in primatology. Now, with regards to YouTube, it's become, you know, the zucchini with cats. But, you know, that object that exists that causes immense fear is a large part of, you know, various kinds of biology. So they needed to have a reactive fear. And my background also is very, I'm very interested in flocking and these kind of things. And flocking also has a fear component to it as well, particularly associated with, you know, stationary birds, what causes them to actually fly and behave like when they're on the ground, for example. Mm-hmm. So fear was critical. Desire was critical. So I started with these two ideas about how I was going to represent them in a simulation sense.
In an early sense, how did you represent those?
I represented them in what, to someone who isn't familiar with neural networks, looks a little bit like a neural network, but it's actually based on my early Petri dish simulation. So there's a phenomenon in Petri dishes. Before I did all of this, I wrote antiviral software. And the thing that fascinated me with antiviral software was the speed at which viruses propagated. So in 2004, 2005, my first example of academic publishing, I wrote a paper about the way I moved from agar simulation, literally Petri dish simulation, to the CogNEB simulation. The ideas there are that there are certain criteria for cells here, you want to call them Petri dish cells, to transmit bacteria and how it flourishes. And that fascinated me as a notion that the movement of bacteria was actually a kind of information transfer.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I wrote the initial cognitive simulation very much based on that in two dimensions. And then I thought, well, what happens if you move it to three dimensions? And here what you have is fundamentally sensors, which are things that produce data in this three-dimensional agar
blob.
And then you have actuators, which produce movement predominantly in there as well. And you're looking at the way information transfers between these two things. Now, fear here has a reaction in time, whereas desire here has a reaction in the space. So there are two competing mathematical properties which enable the information transfer between the sensors and the actuators in this blob. So from that standpoint, the kinds of transference here, I'm talking about it being chemical, it doesn't have to be chemical.
But because you're talking about like a Petri dish and how information travels, you can talk about it chemically.
Mm-hmm. So here, the awake state has different properties to the asleep state. And the awake state is obviously very hypersensitive to fear, whereas the asleep state, those things I think are actually reversed mathematically. I need to go back and read the mathematics. I don't have that form of autism where I can keep all these things locked away. But these two things are different states.
Okay, so
which means that when the noble apes sleep, they actually process information which is beneficial for when they're awake. Let me talk about this associated with space. So as the noble apes move through space, they develop a certain degree of familiarity, which is really the desire component working through, creating a familiarity associated with their movement through space. So one of the early tasks was associated with what would the noble apes draw as a map. So they move through a space, they get familiarity
with
that space.
Some island early on was an island.
Exactly, it was early on was an island. What would the island look like? Well, if the noble apes drew this mysteriously using the simulation, you could see that they were reducing the spaces that were more familiar to them. But also they would gravitate around spaces where they would eat frequently on certain, you know, things that they liked and these kind of things. Social gathering spots also became closer together. So the notion of space was morphed by their experience through this. And that was an early signal to me that the stuff I was doing was actually novel in some regard.
Well, it's interesting because, of course, it matches very well to how our thought process mm-hmm. works around space and memory.
And what's interesting through doing this kind of simulation, I do this periodically, is I spend time with scientists that are familiar in the area and I actually kind of test some of my hypotheses. And what's interesting is because I don't have the language, I mean, I do have some of the language of science, don't get me wrong, but what I love doing is actually putting these ideas out there with scientists and then having to say, ah, yes, that's that principle, and then they explain that. And I remember a few weeks ago, which may even be motivating this discussion, we were talking about what happens with a finite amount of genetic information and what that means in terms of simplification of various, you know, genetic circumstances. That the fact that we have genes that have multiple properties actually means that we will I mean, although it's a long period of time for evolution, we have a faster evolutionary distance than if we had vastly more genes, basically, because we're kind of eliminating certain things, so we only can move in certain ways, but that actually speeds up evolution in particular directions. Okay. And that was something that I came to independently. I have another simulation called Noble Insect, a subset of Noble Ape, which is, if you shrink a lot of these things down, what kind of evolution can you get through them? Like, if you have, rather than a multi-dimensional large cognitive simulation, if you shrink it down to literally 3 points that are interacting, or 4 points that are interacting, pyramid interaction, what kind of simulation can you get out of that? So, do we have people for this room or no? Okay, people are wandering around. Okay. So, through taking these ideas, the validation with scientists is very interesting. I went through a period of time where I wanted to publish academically more than I do currently. And that was very much initially. So the one that I wrote initially that I talked about taking AGAR simulation, Petri dish simulation, moving to cognitive simulation, originally there were like, we were competing for a book, basically. Mm-hmm. And there were about 120 academics and me. And then there were about 50 academics and me. Then there were about 20 academics and me. Then there was me and about 9 other academics, and we were actually published. And I realized I'd been looking at this thing just, I don't know, it's not necessarily humbleness, it's just, it's practical, right? It's the nature of practical things that I didn't see this as being like scientifically profound. I just saw it as being something that I did. But when I started publishing academically, I realized that there was something I could give back to, because academia has a problem associated with, they want to find solutions within their spaces, within the stuff that they're discussing as well. There's very much a kind of narrative sense to academia. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't really approaching that. I was just interested in, digital biological model railroading fundamentally. Mm-hmm. And in doing that, I'd been able to kind of bypass a lot of the stuff that the academics were getting bogged in. And this is something that I think is incredibly important. So I'm involved with an interdisciplinary research group being created currently at UC Santa Cruz. And I think it's really important that you want to get as many different ideas in a space as possible and try to avoid some of this groupthink narrative, for want of a better term. And I've been able to cut through a lot of that with Noble Ape. But it does require me periodically to, break out of my hermitage and go and
collaborate,
talk to academic.
And help write stuff and things like that.
Yeah, just, talk to people, basically, and say, are certain aspects of these emergent behaviors interesting? What I found fascinating is that scientists, particular kinds of scientists, are very receptive to this. Social scientists historically have been receptive in different ways, but the nature of what I do with Noble Ape is relatively removed from things like sociology, for example.
Why?
But increasingly, I think it's probably bad PR on my part. Mm. I think if I talked more with these folk, I would probably find overlaps with the stuff that I do. I don't deal with the scale that most sociologists deal with. And I think certainly the behaviours and phenomena, you want to be able to validate it. So the creation of explicit language, these are stories that the Noble Apes tell that are written down in English, right? These kind of things.
And they created these stories?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Through interactions. So they have interactions and they have stories associated with these interactions.
So these are relatively boring stories?
Well,
from human
actually
perspective?
Actually, this is where it gets interesting. So I've had a background interest, which comes through Kant, of all philosophers. Okay. But there was a gentleman who still does this that created a Kantian simulation, which was fundamentally a language simulation that constructed amazingly elaborate proofs, which were all wrong, but amazingly elaborate. And by making
this... Why were the proofs wrong?
Well, they were just nonsense proofs, right? Which is what's the beautiful thing about Kant is you read it and it could almost be nonsense. Anyway, you can write Baywatch scripts with this thing. So actually, a wide variety... So there's a book out called Life 3.0. And Life 3.0 hypothesizes that we're currently recording at Netflix for folks listening in, that you could create an AI version of Netflix that created tens of thousands of originals every day.
Right.
It's just a computational problem. And then through that, it made money. And through that money, it funded the post-singular world. We can talk a little bit more about that maybe in another recording. But I think what's beautiful through this is if you look at soap operas, I occasionally look at soap operas, they are very much associated with human interactions with certain twists. Mm-hmm. There's a notion in soap operas where you take people and you take them so they cannot actually reach their goal. So at every point where they're about to reach their goal, they're frustrated in some way.
Yeah.
You could do that in simulation terms easily. So what you look at in terms of mundaneness, we talked initially about the epic idea, the ape that's talked about the most within the community mm-hmm. has a particular interest. That's not really that boring. Like, the fact that two apes having a conversation can accidentally change a name, which then propagates through a community, which becomes this birth secret thing.
Right. It's boring as like soap operas are boring. But they're not, right? They're interesting.
I mean, let's talk about the emergence of deities. Let's talk about the emergence of unquestionable leadership. One of the things that Bob Mottram did do, aside from everything else he did, was he looked at modelling political simulations with Noble Ape, with the notion from birth, certainly in the UK, also to a certain extent in this country, the politicians who are selected come from the same areas. They go through similar experiences. We have a very monotheistic, for want of a better term, political circumstance. Mm-hmm. The differences between the two political parties in terms of narrative is just associated with their appealing base. And what's particularly curious, less so in this country, although there are some examples, politicians occasionally switch sides, right? So whether one wants to demean soap operas or politics or these kind of things, they are all simulatable.
Yeah.
And simulatable to a way which makes you... So a lot of secondary stuff that I did, which also might be interesting to your listeners, is once you do this for a period of time, you start wondering... You mentioned Verna Vinge.
Yeah.
Could we be post-singular?
Yeah, potentially. I mean, there's always that thought process, right?
But let's look at the notion of what intelligence is, which is the original reason that you were talking to me. My perspective on intelligence is it's about survival. The notion of intelligence, the only means that you can describe, and I came to this by talking with a paleobiologist called Roy Plotnick. Roy Plotnick describes how cells began eking their way to food sources and the emergence of finding food sources from very simple single cellular organisms and how that became intelligence. This notion of intelligence as survival, I think, is actually a really interesting metric. And if you use that metric...
I mean, isn't that one of the bases of all attributes of existence of life, is that it was a benefit of survival?
Consider... Okay, so once you say that intelligence is survival, consider the road systems, right? The road systems exist and survive independent of... I mean, they're created by humans, but they're vastly more complex than a single human could understand or maintain.
Sure.
Let's look at the economic system.
Right. And you're saying that the... If you think of the road system and the way it exists, it grows over time, it gets more complex, it repairs itself, and in general, you can think of it as an organism outside of any other
aspect. We live in the Bay Area. Yeah. We're very intimately acquainted with this, as you are through your driving too, no doubt. And let's look at points of failure. How many points of failure before the San Francisco Bay Area system
fails?
Well, not necessarily fails, but just becomes practically unusable. And what kinds of circumstances exist in this light? So once you start looking... So
you think of that as an intelligence?
Yeah. Why not?
Okay.
So because you're looking at it in terms of survival. So
the road survival?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
If you look at the road system, if you look at the legal system, if you look at the financial system in particular kills people, right? Very practically. The road system occasionally
kills people.
Kills people. And if you look at the legal system in this country, it kills people. So... In these circumstances, once you have a sense that these systems that we have created but in no way control are vastly greater than we are, then you start having a different respect for things that you hadn't historically had respect for. The notion of human intelligence is really, you know, we have this...
We have a sample of one.
We have this notion of the primacy of human intelligence. So I wrote an article nearly a decade ago called Ape Brain Narcissism Misses the Singularity, which argued that we are caught in all these beautiful paradoxes of our own minds. But
so you're saying it's not that we're... You're not referring to the idea that we're in a simulation right now of a simulation society. You're saying that we already have emergent life forms of intelligence. We just don't think of them as life forms of intelligence.
I wouldn't use the term system, life forms. The legal system. We have complex simulations around us that are vastly more intelligent by a number of appreciable properties than we are.
And you're saying the legal system, the financial system, mm-hmm. the road system, transportation mm-hmm. system.
Mm-hmm. And within that...
It's so funny. I think of that so easily and from a software perspective. Mm-hmm. I had early conversations in the internal podcast for Netflix. I was talking with people that were writing the algorithms on how our sorting system works and how our recommendation system works and talking about, well, who understands this aspect? Who understands this aspect? And if you really, you know, pin down to it, no one person understands the complexity of the Netflix infrastructure. No way. Right? Mm-hmm. And that's true with Google and that's true with Facebook and you name the company. The infrastructures that exist are outpaced the human mind, the ability to understand it. Therefore, is it something else? Mm. And most people answer that question, no, it's not something else. And you would say, yeah, it is something else.
My perspective is that there are qualities. So when I wrote Ape Brain Narcissism, This is the Singularity, I was trying to stoke a wide variety of different levels of discussion associated with academics, popular thinkers. I had Tim O'Reilly, who writes the O'Reilly books, mm-hmm. comment very favourably on the article. But what I wanted to see was the dialogue move forward. I wanted to see something where the people who have historically been talking about this very much, you're familiar, I'm sure, with H+ and, you know, the Singularity Institute and all these folk, who were very proactive about making this thing slightly warm and fuzzy.
Let's talk about this real quick. This mm-hmm. idea of the singularity that comes from a geek perspective is the idea that at some point we'll have an artificial intelligence, that artificial intelligence will grow rapidly, much more so than we do, and therefore at some point will become either insects, but some and unimportant from the perspective of intelligence in general. Mm-hmm. And some people believe that actually that transcendence experience will actually take human consciousness with it. So we'll merge with the superintelligence, we'll become superintelligent, and there'll be like a secondary stage of humanity, well, post-humanity, which will be a singularity-type point that if you stay as a human, you will be lost just like the singularity of a black hole. There won't be a way to get into that consciousness unless you're going in there with it. Is that mm-hmm. a good synopsis?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, I mean,
there's a lot of neat narratives around it.
Everyone has their own perspective on this thing. Yeah. But mine has always been to say that somewhere between, and I'm more sympathetic to the Industrial Revolution the more that I read about it, but somewhere between the Industrial Revolution and the early 80s, in terms of systems that were just vastly more complex and completely subsumed human intelligence. And if you look at that, particularly associated with what they describe as being, about being post-singular, I think you have a better means of exploring some of the rich and paradoxical social circumstances that we find ourselves in now. So the notion of vastly complex systems, be they now social networks, and I know now, finally, these ideas are kind of percolated by other folk as well. But what I was trying to do a decade ago was let's start the discussion maturely associated with how we actually describe these vastly complex systems.
We already have them. Mm-hmm. We should be talking about them.
Exactly. And we should be talking about them with a particular maturity which isn't based on this, I'm an ape, my brain is like this, they're not an ape, their brain is not like that kind of notion. I mean, the whole... It's like horses observing cars, right? Which also I put out there a decade ago and now is finally reaching the popular consciousness. Well, this notion that horses might look over a freeway and say, sure, they're fast, but they'll never be horses. I mean, the whole notion that the human brain has some primary importance or having feelings or emotions or all these kind of things. And I think in particular, the nature of the way technology is used is so completely against broader, more normative notions of humanity.
But, okay, I grant you that. I want to ask you, though, about being a part of or being near a large complex system we don't understand and mm-hmm. that being a type of intelligence that we could say, you know, we already have this quality of another. Hasn't that always been the case with life forms? I mean, when at some state, the ecosystem that you live in is a system that you don't actually understand, but you participate in.
Hmm.
So you could always be describing every system as a complex, other intelligent form, couldn't you?
Welcome to my world. No, I mean, my view is that that's actually the argument. That's the place that people need to get to. And from there actually becomes a number of really interesting narratives. Now, 99.9% of the population are not going to be there. And I think that's the difficulty with the discussion. The discussion hasn't really matured to a point where people actually get to that point and then start exploring. But as you well know, I spent 7 years talking with a linguist down in LA called Heron Stone. The podcast is called Stone Ape. It's still available. We did a refresher a couple of weeks ago. But that was
it's a fantastic podcast, by the way. Still, you can listen to
Thank
it from the beginning.
Thank you. That
takes
was the
time.
Nature, but... believe me. That was the nature of the discussion that we were having. That you need what you need here is not associated with me changing my perspective. It's associated with how do you bring people along? Mm. How do you have a conversation with people where they actually have that point? And then what do you talk about following that, right? So...
Well, I mean, is it just... I mean, not to misuse the term, but isn't it kind of academic? I mean, so what? There's complex systems around that we are interacting with and engaging with, and we're more of an organism in that system than an individual with intelligence. I mean, what kind of things emerge and allow us to benefit our experience by talking that way?
Well, what's interesting is what's lacking in the general discussion. So... the narrative, and this has been codified actually in laws in various countries, if you read Life 3.0, the notion that artificial intelligence, as prescribed by these people, should have various human-centric behaviours associated with it, I think is fascinating. Because we then need to start addressing the way we behave and interact as humans, right? You can't put a series of rules and constraints on an intelligence which isn't human and then ignore the rules and constraints that the humans themselves are not adhering to. Mm-hmm. So I think what comes through this discussion is really an ability to turn something on its head and actually have a broader discussion associated with how did we get into the situation? Like, really, that is the pause point. The pause point is, rather than talk about something dark and distant in science fiction in the future, we are in something
dark
and distant. Exactly, in the present. And let's start talking about this in a mature fashion. Let's not... you know, try to calm people into this thing. Let's just say we're in a position which is distinctly different than the way the narrative has been. Now we need to adjust the narrative around this. So this is where simulation becomes very political, ultimately.
Well, I mean, that's not necessarily simulation. I mean, that's...
No, but this is the analysis that simulation gives.
Allows
the,
you to give.
The way that I got to this position was through... I mean, true, I had other social interests and a bunch of other stuff going on. But the way that I got to this was looking at the stuff that I could actually create. Look at, for example, there's this thing which exists in history which is rarely talked about, which is associated with the impact of wars. Like when you have wars where people have limbs cut off, like vast quantities of people with limbs cut off, what does that do to the society over time? What does PTSD do to a society over time?
Is this understood right now?
Well... it's understood by a small portion of the population, but it's not understood by the... I mean, it's not understood viscerally, mm-hmm. right? So simulating this kind of stuff is actually really fascinating because in simulating this kind of stuff, you get to get data which you can then compare to, like, is the... firstly, the data is not being kept. Like, we're not even doing this stuff with humans. So you write simulations to do this, you don't even have comparable data to work with. But what I found was a really fascinating community of folks in simulation who were treating PTSD fundamentally. And this goes back to the Heron Stone conversations as
in
well.
In simulation?
They were using, yes. They were using things that came out of the simulation, in particular smells, lights, actual, you know, recreation of events in simulation environments. This was predominantly done by UCLA, but there were a bunch of other places that did sure. it as well. And through this, they got really interesting insights in PTSD. And I think what was interesting for me is they were on the fringes of the simulation community. I was part of BIOTA. But they certainly touched on a number of things. And this was another motivation in Stone Ape with linguist Heron Stone, was to look at the way that we have changed our language over time to be non-specific and kind of pro-militaristic with regards to a variety of things. So the whole kind of patriot narrative that we have in this country in particular is associated with avoiding a wide variety of things. You can simulate this, but it's also pretty obvious once you talk to people about it.
Examples of this is the language we use around war.
Exactly. The whole notion of what the enemy is in war, and also how the experience of soldiers is rarely adequately mapped onto language. So the military has its own language to try to encapsulate what is going on,
right.
But even that doesn't map onto the experiences. And there's now so much literature associated with this. I mean, there's so much narrative history in particular associated with Vietnam, but also with the First and Second World War, that it's well understood by a certain group of academics, at least, that there is an issue with regards to language that could really treat PTSD. This could be simulated. It doesn't need to be simulated because we already have the data on this. So my perspective the more that I delved into how simulation can be used practically, the more I realized that it does have a pretty explicit political message that comes through it as well. And that's associated with the fact that there's a wide variety of stuff that we just don't talk about, right? Maybe we should start having that discussion.
I think we do talk about some of these problems, and it almost always feels nihilistic when you do talk about, when you talk about the financial system, right? When you talk about these systems that we've produced, our political system, and how hard they are to change, and how kind of behind the times they are in a lot of ways of thinking. I mean, a great example of that is today was also the day to vote in California. And so I went down and filled out a paper form, and it's just crazy complex or crazy behind the times on how we do this processing compared to how I can communicate with anybody on the planet at a moment's notice. Like, there's a real, those large systems move at a different speed than some other systems move at. So at some level,
in my local area, there was no candidate as well. I need to point that out.
There was no candidate in your area?
The same candidate just continued on. There was no person running against them.
No counter.
No opponent.
Yeah.
So, I mean, my perspective is actually, sorry, I cut you off.
My point was that we do talk about these large systems and the impact they have on us. We just don't talk about them as a model, thinking about them as a form of life, if you will.
Well, we have emotive forces in our descriptions. And I think the thing with simulation, look, it's possible for people to say, you write the simulation, Tom. All your biases are encoded in the simulation. You might say you're not writing rules there, but let's face it, the simulation just confirms your worldview and you're able to talk on a podcast about it.
Right.
And my perspective on that is,
of course, your worldview may have been modified by the simulations as well.
Without question,
But it is a very good point. I kind of want to dive down into the idea that, you know, you say, I thought I would take, you know, fear and
desire
and model those. Like, well, that sounds cool. Poetically, that sounds cool. I have no
visually
idea if that
looks beautiful too.
I bet it's beautiful, but I don't know if it actually represents a core aspect of humanity or of life.
Well, in chemistry terms, fear creates very strong chemical things within us. I mean, you can literally smell fear.
Yeah. It's actually fear and anxiety is one of those ones we're really good at knowing on people now.
Yeah,
we can
certainly
actually detect it using text.
So, I mean, my perspective is that there are a wide variety of ways that you can motivate things. And in parallel to this, I should say that there are other simulators. Larry Yeager created a simulation called Polyworld, where he used neural networks, existing GAN variety neural networks, to simulate his cognitive simulations, his sea monkeys, they were called sea monkeys. Mm-hmm. So there are a wide variety of different things that people can use here for their simulations. But what's interesting is what the simulations create. Is it science? What is it? And part of the discussions that I had through Biota was with a gentleman called Stephen Guerin down at the Santa Fe Institute in New Mexico. And he talked about simulation science and this notion that through simulation, you should be able to create a system, but also you should be able to provide feedback to science from that simulation. And that's something that I've certainly taken away. And that's what I try to do with Noble Ape. Now, true, I have all my own, you know, biases as I look at these
interests.
Things. Yeah, I'm interested in soap opera, so like I see soap operas in there. But I think what interests me is all my work is open source. Even all my audio is out there. If people want to go and reference things, and I occasionally, when I say occasionally, about three times a year, I'm contacted by a skeptic who wants to dig deep into something. And I will spend, in some cases, days going through the source code, going through...
What do you mean, skeptic of your code?
Skeptic that... So, for example, when I first talked about the mutation, the language mutation associated with birth causing something interesting in 2012, and I did this at a conference.
Causing interesting storytelling.
Yeah, exactly.
Occur, and actually the emergence of an important character
so
in society.
So I was contacted then by an academic, and I provided, I think over 3 or 4 days, the actual data and went back and explained it and showed to him. And he said, well, you need to track this over long periods of time in order to do that, and I've done that since. So occasionally, sometimes it's university students. Mm-hmm. They're just like, I've run the simulation, I've drowned countless apes, you know, they're not learning to swim any faster, you know, what's the deal? You know, I mean, there are a variety of these kind of things. But
what's normally the deal there?
What's the deal there? Well, it's interesting, actually, because unfortunately they're killing the apes that they want to propagate the genetics of good swimming. So by like artificially drowning the apes in those circumstances, this was an early one, literally in the first year, I think, of the simulation. And probably actually the individual was relatively local to me. But yeah, so you want to actually allow some of the apes to be nearly drowned and then just get to land. Like the apes that survive after about, I don't know, 30 minutes of forced drowning, you probably should let them get to land so they can propagate genetically so this thing carries on. If you drown all your apes up front, you're not going to get good swimmers, right, unfortunately. Right, right. So, you know, you get these kind of correspondences. And I'm remarkable. Look, when I started podcasting as well, I was contacted more heavily, actually, when I started podcasting. The early days of podcasting, I'm talking here about 2005, 2006, sure. Really 2006. Much smaller community, much more hostile and angry community in some regard. None of those things, people downloading in the cars or anything like that. No, these were obsessive nerd types that had discovered RSS and were getting audio for the first time. And they had, I remember in the first, like after the first, because I did podcasts in this time frame as well, talking about simulation. You'd get these emails from people that were just absolutely furious about something and would want you to prove some acute aspect. And I actually got...
And you actually responded and did that because it was early in net. And you're like, sure, I'll spend all my time doing this.
Believe me, yeah. After about a year, I thought, why am I even doing this thing? And but it's funny, actually, there was a period... So I've gone through a number of cycles with Noble Ape. There was a period of time where I was being contacted probably the late 90s, early 2000s by high school students. I think they stopped teaching certain kinds of programming in high school.
Yeah.
And I think basically we lost a certain... And it's something I'm very mindful of because the majority of Noble Ape is written in C. There's some Objective-C, obviously. There's a bit of Java in some places. And, you know, I'm trying to... I'm always contacted by folk that say, why isn't this written in Perl or Python? And I'm more sympathetic now to writing parts of it just so they can have access to it.
Yeah.
But I've written in C historically, and it makes me a dinosaur in terms of the...
Yeah.
And I think... Through this experience...
I'm sorry, I love that the language of the programming language is another barrier for understanding communication, yeah,
exactly.
Which is fantastic.
Yeah.
So you're saying...
So, yeah, I think I'll take the time, probably more than most, because ultimately... So young folk, now people in their late teens, early 20s, that contact me, and I've done audio interviews with them, mm-hmm. to motivate their own... thinking, how do you create simulations? Like this ultimately is something that I'm returning to more. Are we going to talk about the alleged comedian? Is that going to register in the...
What's the alleged comedian?
So about 2.5 years ago, a gentleman decided that he was going to do a comedy tour and call it Noble Ape. And from that period of time, basically everything that I've done associated with this thing has been...
Protecting your trademark or something?
No, it's just associated with basic hijacking. And what I find particularly curious is now I'm in a state where I've done this work for 22 years now, and the things that excite me and interest me that I want to propagate, clearly I'm going to continue to maintain Noble Ape,
sure.
Without question. But I think what comes out of this is the kinds of discussions that we've been having here. But more importantly, introducing this to a new audience. I've had a few book projects I've had a few book projects percolating along these lines. I've concatenated a lot of that recently. I'm going to call it Simulated Consciousness. The book is going to be called Simulated Consciousness. And it's going to outline the past 20 plus years worth of doing this with the view to motivate a new generation of folk to start writing these kind of simulations and thinking about
similar things. Inspecting simulation as a way of engaging in the world.
Yeah. And also just... Although this may not have come through this conversation, I like to encourage people to think about the fact that these are actually building on relatively simple ideas. And accumulation over time, you can build these simulations as individual entities and then kind of glue them together piecemeal. As people work on cars, you know.
Yeah.
People don't...
Legos and...
Yeah. Well, you know, you take an engine apart within a car and you fix little things in the car and then you put it back together. If you think of simulations as being individual pistons, you have multiple pistons, you put these simulations together, they do different things, but they interact together and create a gestalt which is better than the sum of the parts, basically. And I think this kind of stuff is lost now.
The barrier to play with this is extremely high.
Well, my view is that if you play with mathematics from a young age, you have... So you can derive calculus through just play. You can derive calculus associated with circles and sine waves and cos waves just by looking at deltas in movement.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at movement in particular, you know, escaping from something or going towards something, you can write stuff which will derive trigonometric calculus very easily.
In simulation.
Mm-hmm. And I think what excites me associated with this is just inspiring another generation to do this kind of stuff. I mean, obviously, I've gotten to the place where I am with Noble Ape through my own, you know, wanderings. But people should be able to pick these ideas of simulation up, create their own simulations, find wonder. And ultimately, that's what I do when more often than not now, associated with young folk that contact me, is talk to them about what inspires them.
Yeah.
They're from a completely different generation. I mean, I grew up very much reading, to a lesser extent, Dawkins, but a wide variety of other kind of academic remainders kind of folk that existed in the university bins that couldn't be sold, you know, that students had not picked them up. And there I was like, 50 cents? The philosophy of artificial life, Margaret I. Bowden? Oh, my goodness.
So I like the idea of kind of closing up this conversation with you, because we both, of course, have to go back to work, about kind of what you expect and want people to do in picking this up.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say the barrier to entry is a little high, it seems to me once you get past the excitement, once you kind of show what it can do and how it works and that kind of thing, then you're probably going to pull people along high enough to be interested in diving in.
Do you think the barrier for entry for programming is high?
I think the barrier to entry for picking up tools and getting things running is high. I think the reason why like processing is a great place for people to start in programming is that you just download one app and you start. But most of the time, if you want to even compile in C, you have, you know, an expert person got a half an hour to get a computer running. And that's a hard thing to do when there's no feedback saying this is awesome, you're doing great.
Hmm.
I just recently switched from iOS development to Android development to fix one little bug at Netflix, and I went through the process of just getting my machine to run build an Android app for Netflix. Mm-hmm. It's documented well. There's these experts, like, you know, core level experts in the field are my friends and colleagues, and I just walked to them, and it took me a day to get my machine really running, and now of course I can do it. That barrier to entry is almost on every stack, it feels that way. And so I think that's actually the biggest barrier, not the actual programming, but the actual system setup.
And I think children are receptive to that. The obsessive nature of children should never... When I lived in the UK, people would say to me, you know, in the dark ages, people were just different. Oh, it's filthy. You know, it's Monty Python influencing an entire generation in the UK to view the dark ages as being this, you know, no one had any emotions or feelings. You look at children's toys, both made by adults, but also made by children and children's playthings. This is independent of a wide variety of social things. My perspective is that young folk will be able to do this stuff. The issue currently is more than ever, they're being marketed completely shrink-wrapped, pre-done everything.
Yeah.
And the organic nature of actually tinkering may have been, you know, is a lost cause in some regard. So within that context, my hope is to at least inspire a particular group of deviants to continue this work. And I would certainly engage with your listeners to reach out to me if they are particular naysayers, or even if they just want a friendly chat.
How do they do that?
Well, probably the easiest way is to go to nobleape.com/Tom, nobleape.com/Tom. A wide variety of ways to get in contact with me.
That's a good landing spot, though.
Yeah, good number of podcasts. If they're model railroaders, if they want to check out Stone Ape, if they just are lacking tens of hundreds of hours of audio, that's a good landing spot for you to get your...
And, of course, from there, I mean, prior to, you can actually, of course, run this. If you're on a Mac, you can run this and get it working.
So, as it is currently, I'm currently hacking my way through Metal, so my recommendation is not that they get the tip of what I'm working on currently. Although maybe by the time this podcast is posted, it might be in a better case. But yeah, by all means, if you're interested in running software, get in contact with me. I'm now using GitLab because my primary other developer, Bob Mottram, moved away from GitHub.
Uh-huh.
So I'm on GitLab with all this stuff. There are a variety of different simulations that come out of Noble Ape as well. So as I noted, I have a planetary simulation, I have the urban simulation, I have a warfare simulation. Bob Mottram worked extensively on a functionally based skeletal simulation.
What's skeletal?
Skeletons.
Skeletons,
but
oh, okay.
Blood flow and diseases and a wide variety
how
of things.
How the skeletons actually get working.
Yeah, yeah.
So when you talked about the planetary one, if I were to go and want to play with the planetary simulation, because of course it's always fun to do that, what would the steps be for me to do that? Would I be able to download a binary and run it, or would I have to compile something?
Currently, normally you'd compile it. Historically, you'd download a binary, but this is, I'm reintegrating this to be like a first-class citizen with a Noble Ape. So eventually, it will just be part of the Noble Ape simulation. My aim is, as time allows, maybe in the next year or two, that this is a first-class component of the Noble Ape simulation, which means you just download the Noble Ape simulation, you get the full thing there.
It's right there, right?
Yeah.
In fact, they're actually part of the solar system.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this is in part, you know, the work I'm doing currently with Metal is just to get more GPU, basically. So,
and you need the GPU just to be able to visualize how cool these things are.
Exactly.
Do they, when you worked on the Noble Apes being able to walk, how are they currently walking? Did you procedurally define that, or do they emerge that quality?
So the walking part, Noble Ape currently is fundamentally a two-dimensional simulation. There is a walking component to it. There is a skeletal component to it.
Like it knows boundaries to climb and
exactly,
go hiking, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So you would add things to get the skeletons moving. Which isn't in the primary simulation. The primary simulation is very much based on the notion that the apes interact with things and gather data in relative space.
Yeah.
So rather than simulating every step of the Noble Apes, what I'm simulating is their broader movement. If they have injuries or things like that, then that's
impactful. They might be slower,
exactly.
And their social interactions slow them down.
Or they might be hungry or these kind of things.
All those patterns.
The skeletal simulation is certainly there. And as I say, the aim is to move all these things into Noble Ape.
But in a 2D world, I can't. Why are you currently GPU bound?
Well,
or is it that you want to use different processes on the GPU?
So historically, I used OpenGL, and there I wasn't particularly GPU bound. Apple eliminated OpenGL. I mean, there's a Windows version and there's a Linux version, but I primarily work on Mac, so I primarily maintain the Mac version. Mm-hmm. And Noble Apes had a history with Apple as well, so I kind of feel obligated in some regard. So I moved off OpenGL to Core Graphics. Core Graphics, you're really, 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 really GPU bound. If folks find my video on YouTube, I actually cut the percentages down associated with how GPU bound you are. So the movement to Metal is associated with freeing up literally, like it goes from 50% to 10% of the processor related to basic drawing. Like Core Graphics is really like not being optimized by Apple.
Okay.
So yeah, that's what that's about.
Okay.
That's about returning me to
a stable ground where you were in OpenGL.
Exactly. So I can actually do things. But I mean, to be fair, I'm simulating, you know, days in seconds, basically.
Right.
So I'm doing a lot of processing in a small amount of time on a large data set.
But that's only if you want to render it and show it, right? I mean,
that's actually associated primarily with the weather, the cognitive simulation. There are simulation components. I mean, the cognitive simulation for each of these apes is pretty serious. Certainly that was the work that Apple and Intel did. So that was very much the main processing that was used there. And
it's just like that internal dialogue you described earlier with multiple actors and how it works.
If you just look at the cognitive simulation, as I described with the fear and desire, you're simulating multi-dimensional mathematics in far better than real time.
Right.
So the mathematical core was certainly the early interest for Apple and then Intel associated with their optimization.
Do you think that your initial idea of making a three-dimensional communication system that was kind of like a petri dish has superior qualities than a traditional mathematical neural net?
Well, I did at the time. I mean, perspective. Well, look, neural networks have been optimized, right? That's what I missed out on with a lot of the stuff.
Yeah.
I rolled my own graphics. Graphics have been optimized. Ironically, though, when I went back to polygonal graphics for these things, there were still advantages in the graphics that I created. So, yeah, look, neural networks is they're now optimized on.
Yeah, there's hardware optimization on the devices. Yeah,
so
you can't really beat that at some level.
Yeah, on some level. Like, I'm a dinosaur on so many different levels. But my perspective with this is that I'd like these things to be easily plug and playable and pull outable. And what I see, particularly moving simulations onto this kind of stuff,
on your phone,
is that you have to use. You have to use what's there. You have to basically, because in this case, Apple, in the case of Android, you know, Google, they actually put in serious hours to get things to work properly. And if you start to, these things get very toasty very quickly if you're using the wrong stuff.
You're referencing your phone. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I'm pulling it out.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that you can't ignore.
Yeah.
So you're always, this is why I started by saying you're always bound by the fact that you're practically working on some software platform that you have to work around, which means a romantic view of me twiddling my fingers and pondering language just isn't the practical nature of what Noble Ape is. The practical nature of Noble Ape is it's active software. Apple does an operating system update, and they change the way views are rendered, and then I have to spend two nights rewriting the view handling.
Sure. Yeah, no,
you know,
a
so
yeah.
This is the nature.
Well,
of
I'm glad that you're dedicated to a project and keep going on it. I find it. I'm trying to find. I guess the railroad. You know, the creating simulated worlds, or maybe. Dungeons and Dragons or other kind of live war simulation systems where there are complex mathematics behind it and people engage and play around that. That to me seems like the closest parallel to what you're doing.
Yeah.
And I'm just fascinated that it feels like it's a new way of doing exploration. Mm-hmm. And calling it simulation in some sense feels like it limits that the core idea of it, right? Because sure, that's what you're producing is simulation.
But what would you call it?
I don't know, but it's a new way that we can engage. I mean, I just recall that my daughters had this strange math problem they had to solve. It was like a bonus question. Mm-hmm. And it was complicated. And I was like, oh, you could probably just render all solutions to this. And they're like, what are you talking about? So over the night, we wrote the software necessary, just a simple JavaScript. I think it was, I can't remember exactly how we did it. But they understood it enough. Mm-hmm. They couldn't write it, but they understood the idea of it. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, we spit out, 15,000 answers to this problem. And some of them were correct, you know. And just seeing, being able to do that from tools in my home is a different level of way of thinking about the world. You can do things differently with these kind of tools. Mm-hmm. And what your life work in some ways is another exploration of that. It's kind of play, it's kind of research, it's kind of art, it's kind of philosophy. Mm. And I like that I don't want to separate it and name it one thing. I think it's all those things.
Well, I'd call it Noble Ape if a comedian hadn't hijacked the term. So. Let's leave it at that, Lyle. It's been a real pleasure to have the chance
to chat with you. Real pleasure, Tom. Thank you so much. You can learn more about Tom at nobleape.org.
Not .com. Early on, I got .com, and people have given me for it, and I just stick with it.
Stick with it. Nobleape.com, and of course, /Tom, if you want to engage with him and learn more about it. Thank you so much, Tom. That was great.
Thank you, Lyle. Wonderful.